Well, we're going on now with the ending of chapter 14 of Romans. We've been considering this chapter in which Paul has primarily dealt with the issue of the evaluation of or judging of the various approaches to faith and life on the earth. Now, by approaches to faith and life, I'm talking about approaches to certain customs and habits, approaches to the matter of foods, for example, and celebrations or days of special worship, days given to religious rites and so forth. He's just dealing with the matters that have to do with the way we conduct ourselves on the earth. And there are several theses here, several major ideas that he's trying to get across. One of them is that we have no business to judge anybody else. Paul is making a really significant point in this matter. And if we would relax a little bit in these things and just take the spirit of other people for what it is and not worry too much about the outward appearance, we would probably do much to weld the body of believers together. But you can't have much togetherness when everybody is judging everybody. I'm astounded when a person tries to influence another person in regard to their life, to their decisions or whatever. I'm astounded because of the amateur factor. If you've got a relative or a friend who is trying to persuade you to take a given course of action, it is astounding that that relative or friend should feel capable of doing that, should take the responsibility for another person's life. How can you take responsibility for somebody else's life? You don't know what your words are going to do to alter their course. And if their course is altered incorrectly, you're responsible. I've made some pretty strong statements about this in regard to parents. Parents ought to realize that they have the life of their young people in their hands and that they ought to make their judgments in the Spirit. When a parent says, "Now, I think you ought to go to college," to a young person, for example, they better be saying that in the Spirit or not say it at all. They better have prayed about that and really believe that in all honesty and all reason they're giving a sound judgment on that. Because a young person can go to college and get in the wrong crowd and be destroyed. Or take a turn in their life that takes them away from Christ and into some field of things that would be totally contrary. It isn't just automatically true, for example, I'm just taking that as an illustration, it is not automatically true that everybody ought to go to college. It might be more automatically true that most people shouldn't. We got enough eggheads running around now. And I say that having spent quite a number of years in college and university and so forth. On the other hand, the parent that tries to send their young people off in another course of action, whatever it is, they just better be sensitive to the fact that Christ has a part in this. Now, I am not saying that parents should be infallible, nor am I trying to lay a guilt trip on you if you have been just very, very sensitive and trying to do the right thing but haven't always known. That's a different thing. A parent that really cares to guide their young people in the right way and they're sensitive to the Spirit and not just to their own selfish interests. See, they're sensitive to the Spirit. What do you want to do, Lord? What do you want me to tell my young people? Now, that's all they can do. And I give plenty of encouragement to that person to say, well, when you've done all you can do, you can't do any more than that. And then it's up to the Lord and to that young person to carry it out. So I wouldn't ever lay a guilt trip on a parent who is really conscientiously trying to be a proper guide. But I'm talking about the parent that just automatically assumes that the young people ought to do this or they ought to do that or the other thing, you see. By the same token, we ought to be very, very careful how we talk to other people about what they ought to do. It's tough enough for somebody who has the experience and the training and the charge from God. If you're a a pastor or a teacher, a shepherd, it is an almost overwhelming responsibility to be charged with helping somebody make decisions about their life. I've unfortunately been in the position of having to speak to hundreds and hundreds of people about things that have altered the course of their lives. That is a terrible responsibility. I don't even want it. If I had any way to get out of it, I would get out of it. And that's why I've always said people who seek leadership don't even understand it. If they come to you for guidance, that's a different thing. Then what you should do is tell them, I'm not going to give it to you anyway. People don't even want guidance when they ask for it. And usually it's rhetorical when they ask you what to do. They don't really want to know what to do from you. The better thing is just to stay back. Stay back. Otherwise, you might be charged with the responsibility of having misdirected somebody. Now, when people are moving along in a certain stream of life with Christ, you have to leave that stream alone. Now going to the subject of just the person's conduct or activities, not their decision-making, but just their activities. You don't know what struggle they're having with Christ over certain matters. You don't know the priorities that Christ has in mind for their lives. And you can tip the balance. You can discourage somebody, tip the balance, and throw them way off by prematurely pressing them on issues that they're not ready to be pressed on. I will give this as a classic illustration. A young man who'd been deeply involved in a drug traffic, heavily, was not just a pusher, but a dealer at a pretty high level, had come to Christ in our work, subsequently was arrested for old offenses that he had, they finally caught up with him on, and he was in jail. He needed an attorney. I, at the time, did not have anyone in mind in the area, myself, didn't know anyone, and had one recommended to me. It was a Christian attorney, in quotes. We went to see the young fellow in jail. He came out to meet us smoking a cigarette. And this attorney, who was a very gung-ho Christian type, was very incensed that he should be smoking a cigarette. And he said, well, I thought that you accepted Christ. How can you love Jesus and have that cigarette hanging out of your mouth? And I'm going to be very honest with you. Well, I wanted to punch him in the nose for saying that. Because I said, if you knew what he had been indulging in, this would look like a lollipop. You see. I mean, here the fellow had got off of heroin and all kinds of stuff. He's got a cigarette. That is just, I cannot give you the proper description of what I think about that kind of thing. See. But subsequently, I watched that young fellow go through some quite strenuous exercise over this. Well, maybe I'm not a Christian, you see. Well, it was just nonsense. I mean, he should have left the fellow alone. Just leave him alone. Pray for him. Love him. Because for every kind of fault that we have two or three ourselves. You know, it's just stupid to me. Absolutely stupid. For one human being to sit in judgment of another human being. As though we had our catalog of sins, and this one was second in line, and this is five, and this is number eight, and you fortunately are only doing 9 and 10 yourself, and you're getting them for 1 and 2. It's just stupid. I can't think of a better word than that. Leave people alone. Pray for them. Love them. Try to help them be in their corner, especially with your young people. You got to be in their corner. You brought them into this world. That doesn't mean you have to accept what they do. It doesn't mean you have to condone it. It doesn't mean you have to be a patsy or whatever, or to let them take advantage of you. But one thing you can do is let them know that you're in their corner, see? You don't agree with everything. They're causing difficulties, perhaps, but you're in their corner. You want the best for them. And that sometimes gives you fits because you may be pressed to try and help them to achieve the best, and they may not always appreciate that. But one thing you can do is let them know that you're in their corner, and if there is a way you can help them, you want to do it. We brought them into the world and gave them our genes. You stop and think about that for a minute. Whose genes are they working on when they're ornery? You know, nobody ever consulted a poor kid when they were going to bring a child into the world. I've often said birth is a terrible thing to lay on a poor child, you know. But, you know, you bring them into this world, it's a pretty rough place. Well, we do it, and these kids survive and so forth. All I'm saying is you got to be in their corner. You can pray for them, love them, or care for them in the Lord. Don't let them take advantage of you necessarily. I don't mean to have to be hanging around your neck for 50 years. After 30 years, it might be time to do something else, see? But by the same token, we ought to be in one another's corner as Christian brothers and sisters, family. We're all a family. You're going to lift people a lot better by expressing confidence in them, not confidence in their own capacities so much as confidence that the Lord is with them, you know, that they're part of the family. And to pray for people. But try to understand that their circumstances are different than your own. And you and I, under the same circumstances, might not even do quite as well, see, with the way we handle it. Everybody's psyche is different. Everybody's circumstances are different. And you've got that mix of personality and circumstance and heredity and all is this mix, which gives us, you know, just untold billions and billions of combinations, possibilities of circumstance to personality. And it just no two of them are alike. You know, when we come to a meeting like this, there are as many different combinations of genes plus personality plus circumstances as there are individuals here. That's why when we speak to you, things seem to maybe come out in a disjointed fashion in a lot of ways, but that's because the Lord is trying to hit 30 or 20 or whatever different number of people. And there'll be a line that we say or a phrase or something that hits different ones and hits them differently. And there is a combination of things we're talking about that will somewhere, somehow touch your own particular need, you see. But if I were to give you a very lovely can of corned beef here and serve it up with complete with outline and illustrations, proper introduction and conclusion, if I were to do that, I would probably miss all of you. But this is a very common way to go at Bible teaching. You know, you've got this neat little outline and you've got all these little elements under the outline. Everybody goes away wonderfully knowledgeable, but not particularly knowing how to live. What I'm trying to give you is this gut stuff, how to live. How to live with your family, how to live with the people of the Lord around you, you see. And one big way is just quit judging people. And let the Lord do the judging. He's a better judge than we are. And above all things, keep that oral cavity closed. You can hurt people badly, you can misguide them. You can discourage them by some well-intentioned but ill-advised comment. You remember how it was in the family when you were, when the children were little, and something comes up, and two or three of the children or one chimes in, and they try to add their two cents, and what do the parents say? Just let me handle it. Just stay out of it. We don't want the children correcting each other. We want to take care of ourselves. But isn't that what happens all the time among believers? The children are correcting each other. And the Lord would like to say, just keep out of it, you know. Keep out of it. Well, the concluding thing is astounding to me that any human being should want the responsibility of misdirecting somebody else's life. And it happens all the time. Young people, let's say there's a young person graduating from high school, trying to find their footing, get themselves put together. And how many people, relatives, friends, church members and so forth, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Oh, what? You mean you're not going to college? Or haven't you got a job yet? And why don't you do this and that? And it's really damaging. And my policy was to give space, you see, and like my young people had to come to grips with what it was they wanted to do, but try and push them would have probably stripped their gears. So we just had to be patient with it. The main thing then is to be patient with one another, just back off. Now Paul says some other very strong things here, and he says in verse 13, let us no longer judge one another, but judge this rather not to put a stumbling block before your brother, like an occasion of stumbling or an offense for your brother. What that means is the person is running along, things are going pretty well, and you throw them a curve. You make some dumb comment or some critical judgment about something, you cause them to stumble. You throw them off balance. People think they're going along all right, and then somebody throws some comment in there that they stop and wonder, well, wait, maybe I'm not doing all right. So he says, don't put an occasion of stumbling your brother's way. He said, because I am persuaded in the Lord Jesus that nothing is common of itself except what is accounted as common. That maybe is common. And what he means by that is unsanctified. Basically, it would apply, let's say, to foods. In the Jewish law, there were certain foods that were regarded as unclean. Common meant unclean, unsanctified, not blessed of God. And so there were certain foods that were common, that is, they were not regarded as sacred, and there were some foods that were not common. And now, the Jews were not supposed to eat what were called common foods, and that is, they were unclean. Now, when Peter was commissioned to go to the Gentiles, prior to that commission, he was praying on the rooftop of a friend, and he had this vision of sheets of a large old tarpaulin let down from the sky with unclean animals, considering the Jewish law of ritual cleansing. There were certain things, pigs, for example, were not clean to eat. That's why the Jews never eat pork. That is, the Orthodox Jew would not eat pork. So they would never eat that. That would be to them an abomination. So here comes a great tarpaulin with all these animals on it that were unclean by Jewish law. And the voice came, arise, Peter, kill and eat. And Peter said, not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean. And God's comment to him was, what God hath cleansed, that call not thou common. Now, what is the impact of that? In the first place, directly, Peter was supposed to go to the Gentiles. Now, the Jews would have no dealing with the Gentiles. The Jew felt that the Gentile was unwashed, unclean. And they called him that, unwashed Gentile. Because they were, the Jews regarded themselves as God's special people, and the Gentiles were simply on the outs and had no right to the sacred rituals of the Jews. So, Jesus was preparing Peter, a Jew, to go to the Gentiles and not to take the attitude that the Gentiles were not touched of God. So he said, what God has cleansed, that call not thou common. Now he says, we're throwing the rule book out in favor of something deeper. The Spirit of Christ giving a new set of rules that included everybody rather than excluded everybody. Now, Paul is really applying that specifically here to things like food. the celebration, as I said, of holy days and so forth. He is really saying, if you think that every day in the week is alike, and you feel from God at peace about that, well, he said, that's fine, just let it be that way. But he said, if you think you ought to take one day and set it aside as special, that's all right, too. In other words, to say that it was unsound to regard every day alike, if you would regard, for example, a Sabbath, let's put it that way. The Sabbath was a day that was very sacred to the Jewish people, and anybody who didn't observe the Sabbath was going contrary to their law. Paul offered a new attitude toward this, and he said, if you think the Sabbath is a day that you can work or that you can do other things, that's up to you. He said, some people regard every day as holy. Some people regard one day as holy. Now, he makes that specific point, that some people think every day is a day that the Lord has blessed. So whether you worship on a Monday night or Tuesday night or Sunday or whatever is not a matter of legal requirement. We happen to call Tuesday night sacred. We come here and we fellowship and we study the Word together and we are doing our own thing and worshiping. This is a way of worshiping. You don't have to have necessarily a special ritual or format to worship. Just coming here is a worship. Coming here is saying to God, here we are. Now, this cuts across a lot of conventional lines today as far as what people ought to do, and some think that if you're not in church on Sunday and if you were to come Tuesday night instead, that you're really sinning against God. But there's nothing in the Bible that says that. Nothing that says you ought to have two or three days, and nothing that says that you ought to have the first day of the week or the seventh or whatever. You just let it come as it will in your own heart. But the main thing, he says, is don't judge somebody else about it. The Pharisees, for example, kept all the dietary laws and all the laws down to the letter, but they didn't have any peace in their heart. Now, if there's somebody that is just going along in their Christian life and they love the Lord, they care about Christ, they're hanging in there amidst great difficulty and so forth, don't throw them a curve by insisting that if they don't follow this particular regulation or that one, that they're not very good Christians. The thing that marks the presence of Christ in us is, as I've said over and over again, that we care about Christ and not that we do everything precisely correctly. Because even the people that strive the hardest to do everything right don't always do everything right anyway. You will far more likely straighten out your life and organize it if you have a vital identity with Christ first. Therefore, we try not to put any barriers between Christ and the people to say you have to do this and this and this before Christ will accept you. You come to him just as you are. In one of our meetings, we had a young couple that had been quite deeply involved with the mafia. And we happened to be working in a program that attracted that kind of people. But anyway, they were pretty deeply mixed up in it. They got a lot of problems. So when they came to the meeting, they began to get some interest. That's a long story. I won't go into it. But they got into trouble down in Mexico and surrounded by guns, and they decided they better get things straightened out. Anyway, they came to the meeting, liked it, and got interested. So then they came to me, and they said, we'd like to come to Christ, but we've got so many things here. And they had warrants for arrest in other states, you know, just a whole lot of things that were against them. And so I said to them, well, just come to Christ right now. Don't wait to get things straightened out. Just bring your bag in and put it down and say, Lord, here's my bag of things. We're going to have to work them out and take care of them, but I want to come to Christ now. Well, which they did. And they kept coming back to the meetings. I never said anything to them. I said, now, wait, don't you think you better straighten this out or that out? I just let them alone. And then before long, they came to me, and they said, you know, we think that we ought to do something now about these matters, and we've got warrants out and so forth. And I said, well, I think that's a good idea, but I said, don't just go do it on your own. Go through a lawyer or something, get it taken care of, get it done properly, which they did. But the point is this. I could have made them get everything squared away first, then come to Christ, but that's begging the question. Is this, that's getting the cart before the horse. You come to Christ first. You never put anything in the way of somebody coming to Christ. Never tell a person they can't pray. Never tell a young person, for example, you can't pray to Christ, you give up your drugs or whatever else they're doing, because that would be just contrary to the word as well as dumb. Because how in the world are they going to get the help if they don't get Christ? So you can't clean up your life first, then come to Christ, because you haven't got the strength. If you could clean up your life first, why would you even need Christ anyway? I don't care what the condition of your life is tonight, or how many things are haywire in it. You're just as open. You're just as welcome to talk to Christ as anyone. How are you going to get help unless you talk to Christ? He knows what you're like. He knows what your problems are. Just bring your bag in and set it down and say, Lord, here it is. It's something I can't seem to get hold of or handle, but I belong to you. We just performed a service, funeral service, for a young man who was killed in an automobile accident a few days ago. And there's one of the young men that we'd been working with, been in the drug traffic. And this fellow had a very difficult time getting his act together. From the moment of our encounter to the day that he died, he had an irrepressible concern for Christ, caring about Christ. And the result of this young man's life, and many, many things we were working in together in terms of working with people in trouble, just an incredible number of things, number of people, of young people have come out of those meetings that we had. Just a tremendous, what shall I say, impact from this young man's life. And yet, basically, he had difficulty getting his act together, you know, all the years that he was doing this. But he cared about Christ, very avid in helping other people, other young people especially. He had a great spirit about him, you know, as far as his attitude toward others, his concern for others and everything else. And yet, in terms of what people might call success, victorious Christian living, in quotes, there was not a whole lot of it there. But he cared about Christ, and he carried that on through. But you see, somebody might look at that and say, well, why didn't he get his act together? Well, maybe if they had his act to perform, they wouldn't have been able to get it together either. Yes, we ought to live well. We ought to live successfully. I wouldn't in any way discourage that. We ought to behave ourselves. This young fellow paid a tremendous price for some of his misdeeds. We pay an awful price sometimes for our carelessness in terms of our living on the earth. We make mistakes, and they cost. So I would never encourage you to be careless about your lives. But problems with your lives do not keep you from Christ. How are you going to get help if he isn't with you? He doesn't run like a scared rabbit every time Satan shows his head. You know, people think, well, if Satan comes along and Jesus runs out the back door while you're entertaining your guest. But that's just not the way it is. Christ is going to stand firm with us, and nobody will if he isn't. Who's going to stand for you if Christ doesn't? And you think to yourself, if you had a young person, one of your own young people that came to you and said, you know, I'd really like your help, that'd be a delightful day, wouldn't it? Mostly they don't want anything to do with you, but, you know, if they come and I'd like your help, dad, mother, whatever, why don't you think Christ feels the same way? You may be a rascal or a ragamuffin or whatever, but you come to Christ and you say, Lord, I need your help. Well, he's going to stay in your corner with you. And things might not come easily. They might not get easily straightened out. But he's going to stay with you anyway. Psalm 139 says, if I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. Now, there are people today in this world, in this life, who unfortunately have made their bed in hell. And their life has a lot of wrinkles in it that have come as a result of mistakes and carelessness and so forth. But Christ is with them in it. Not all those things are going to get straightened out. People run off and get married, for example. They marry the wrong person and they think, oh, well, we'll just get a divorce if it isn't any good. You just don't divorce people. You go through the legal motions, but you think you can get rid of somebody just because you wave bye-bye to them? If any of you have ever been through it, you know that it's just years and years of problems that accumulate and that accrue to a situation where there's a divorce. But the Lord can be with you in the middle of those problems too. But what I'm saying is, it's not such a simple thing. Some young people have said, I want to make my own mistakes. And my attitude is, if you don't get some help, by the time you get through making your mistakes, there won't be anything left to do with your life. It'll be all used up. You only have one chance in some situations. Many people today in this world have their bed in hell. But Christ will be with you there and see you through and will help you hang steady even while the pieces of your life are trying to come together, sometimes successfully and sometimes not. But he's with you. And I've said to you often that I've performed a lot of funerals, and I don't think I've ever yet performed one for somebody that I thought had their head together all the way. Everybody's got some wrinkle, some pieces flopping around somewhere. You know, you think you're going to start out at age 18 when you reach adulthood, according to the state, and you think you're going to start out at that age and that you're just going to make a nice, steady progression. You're going to get richer and richer and wiser, and you're going to do things better and better. And you don't realize that 20 years down the road, you're going to make some dumb, stupid mistake that'll cork you, you know. And all the folly is not in the young, I have to say to you. You have on the earth young fools and old fools. You see? But in one way or another, most people are dingy. And they live dingy. People live dingy lives. And there may be one segment of that life that looks pretty good. Here's somebody who's got a nice job in a bank, or they've got a nice home, or they've got something, and they look pretty good. And you say, gee, that person, boy, I wish I was together like that. And yet every other part of their life might be in shambles. Sure, and you've got somebody that has such a lovely family, and you think, oh, if only my family were as lovely as that family. But you weren't around in the morning at breakfast time, or you wouldn't think it was such a lovely family, see? Or that sweet young lady getting ready for the date, you know, you just don't know what a shambles is left behind. Shakespeare had it pretty good, pretty wise, when he said, all that glisters is not gold, you know. So we human beings on the earth are full of folly. What fools we mortals be is a very sage statement. We're all fools. Some are just a little more than others, and some at different times than others. One time in your life, you're pretty smart. Another time, you're pretty dumb. But we do the best we can to chug along, given the circumstances which are the results of our various errors, and we take that collection of idiocies, and we live with it. And we shape it up a little here and there and put a paint job on it. But it's still the same old basket of idiocies that we started with. Now, where does that leave the progressive, victorious Christian? It leaves them with a facade. Let me tell you, I've been around a lot of Christians. There's an awful lot of facade. And that person shouting victory on Sunday may be singing the blues on Monday, see? So don't pay any attention to that. Just take your little basket of parts, carry it along with you, and just trust the Lord to help you put it together somehow. And the problems are laid end to end throughout your life. You get through with this problem, you got another. They're just laid end to end. Like the football game, you see? The moment you step on the turf, you got problems. That's what the game of football is, problems. And from the time you step on the turf till you roll off of it, or they carry you off, you just got one string of problems after the other. And that's the way life is. And the football player doesn't say, hey, let's hurry up and get through this quarter so we can not have any more problems. No, because he knows the next quarter they're going to have more problems. They'll carry you off the field one of these days, and then your problems will be ended. But meanwhile, don't look at the next person to you. Don't look at somebody else and judge them for their problem or for the way you think they ought to be handling their problems. Can't even handle your own. And if you were in their same circumstances, you probably wouldn't do as good as they are. See? So just leave people alone and love them and care for them and leave yourself alone. Don't badger yourself either. Just chug along day after day and take your problems and work with them and be at peace. Trust Christ to get you through. And He will. He'll get you through. And in fact, that's what Paul says in this chapter. He says, and the Lord will make him stand, you see. He says, before his Lord he falls or stands, or stands or falls. Before the Lord he stands or falls. But the Lord will make him stand. It isn't how you feel about your strength or about your being sustained. It is God with you, sustaining you. Point I mean by that is, the Lord is sustaining you in ways you may not even realize. You may not feel good about your situation, but if the Lord weren't sustaining you, you'd be wiped out. See what I'm saying? You may not always feel good about things, but that doesn't mean the Lord isn't sustaining you, you see. The crucial issue then, you care about Christ. You come to the end of the day, it's been a headache and a heartache and chaos, whatever. You still care about Christ. You still want Him in your life. You still want Him to help you. You still care what He thinks about your day, you see. And if you're discouraged, the reason you're discouraged is because you're laying it over against Christ. If you didn't have Christ as your standard, you wouldn't be discouraged with it, see. You'd just say, oh, well, that's the brakes and go on. Just hold steadfast and be at peace. Oh, let's pray. Father, we ask You to bless this fellowship tonight. These people that are here need Your help, Your sustaining grace. You put them in Your hands. In Christ's name, amen.